Evening, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Kick Arts, Auckland's comprehensive arts programme, coming to you on 104.6 FM or live stream at planetaudio.org.nz. I'm your host, Paula Crimmins, for the next 90 minutes, bringing you a show full of wonderful contributions, including Borrowed Time, A Gambler's Guide to Dying. We've got quite a bit about death on this evening, just to prepare people. And we'll be coming to you in just a little bit. That's on at the basement very soon. So that's John Burrows.
Yes, hello.
Yes, good to see you. Welcome.
Welcome, welcome. Thank you.
And also we've got Alison Jones here.
Kia ora.
With her Two Eye, A Traveller in Two Worlds, that she won the category for illustrated nonfiction recently. So it'll be very good to hear all about that. She wrote that along with Cooney Carr Jenkins. And we've also got Ben Moore here.
Hello.
The director for Dying to Meet You.
That's right.
And we'll talk about that in just a minute. And we've also got, we've got a really hugely busy show on tonight. We've got Kavi Chetty.
Kia ora.
Who's coming to us from Auckland Museum. He's going to be chatting about his fabulous new exhibition, The Secret World of Butterflies. And last but not least, the lovely Richard Green.
Kia ora, Paula.
Who is going to be my wingman this is my maiden voyage.
You know, it's going to be a fun show, and I'm looking forward to just sitting on the wing side listening and contributing where I can.
And chatting.
You've been practising really hard, though.
I have.
Faux shows and all sorts.
I have been. I did a little practice show a couple of days ago, but that was much less nerve-wracking than the live thing.
Mum will support you all the way.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
So, anything I can do to help, just... I'm going to talk about... I'm going to contribute on two conversations tonight because I went to the opening of Secret World of Butterflies.
Oh, I can't wait to hear about that.
8:30 on Saturday morning.
Yes.
With a whole lot of preschoolers.
Oh, really? How was that?
And breakfast.
Was there a lot of preschoolers?
Oh, my goodness.
But that's great to see them in the museum.
Preschoolers in a play school.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That was good.
Yeah.
That's the book, because there was a book launch. I'll talk about that as well.
Okay.
Speaking of books, I'm reading at the moment. It's amazing.
Well, why don't we talk to Alison a little bit about that? Because I'm very pleased that it won the category for illustrated nonfiction. Mm-hmm. So well done you. So maybe if you just tell us a little bit about it, exactly what is it about?
Okay, kia ora, Paula. It's a story of a young man who comes from the Southern Bay of Islands, who went to England and returned in 1818, which was well before the treaty. Young Māori man from a group of hapū called Ngāti Raumati. And he was a really interesting young man because he played a huge role in being a go-between for the first Pākehā settlers in New Zealand. So he was one of the young Māori men who was involved in going to Australia and basically engaging with Pākehā over there to get some of them to come and settle in New Zealand.
Right.
And then after that, he went on a fascinating tour of England. He went through Shropshire and he went to Kent with his friend Titiri, lived in London for a while. And he learnt a lot about England while he was there, and this is 1818, so well before the treaty. And it's really a book about the strategies of Māori to engage with Pākehā.
Right.
From probably around about 1800, 1805 onwards. So it really only just goes up to about 1824 when he died, but that early period before the treaty.
I didn't know he died.
Spoiler.
Oh, we haven't got to the
spoiler
end of the book.
Alert.
Oh, no.
So there must have been a lot written then. Did he write or is there other people writing?
Yeah, there was a lot that we found when we started looking. We looked in diaries and letters and all sorts of things in the archives in England where he had been, and there were a number of people there who kept diaries about their visit there, luckily.
Yes.
Of course, there were newspaper accounts of their visits because when they turned up in a place like Shrewsbury in England, it was advertised in the newspaper by the churches who wanted a big turnout So they would say, you know, real live cannibals coming to our church service on Sunday, right, and they're going to hold the plate and you better come and give lots of money for the poor heathens.
Right.
So it was a way of them collecting money for their missionary service. Mm-hmm. And I think people just flocked to see the real live cannibals.
He was a celebrity.
They often visitors from India or Africa or New Zealand or wherever who were there at, you know, who did come and visit England, and were treated like celebrities.
Advertised as chiefs as well, weren't they?
Oh, yes.
New Zealand chiefs.
So right.
Yeah. It was kind of a status. It was a great status for them there.
Yeah.
And it's illustrated, so there must have... What are the illustrations? Are they lithographs or newspaper?
There's a whole lot of beautiful drawings that Tuai did. These are the first Māori drawings on paper with quill and ink.
Wow.
That they drew while they were in England. And luckily they survived and came back to New Zealand. So they're actually in the Auckland City Library in the Gray Collection. These beautiful early Māori drawings of waka and some tamoko. Some beautiful pictures, yes.
His brother's face, didn't he? The tamoko for his brother's face.
Yes,
he did. To show them what a full moko looked. Because he only had half a moko.
Yes. Yeah, he was quite a young man. And so he'd only had half of his face done. Mm. And he hadn't been in many big fights. And he hadn't been a warrior, if you like, at that time. So, and when he was in England, the missionaries told him that he must not get the rest of his face tattooed, because it was savage and it was primitive to do that. But one of the first things he did when he got back to New Zealand was to have his full face done, because he was a Māori man. Mm. And although he was interested in what the missionaries had to say in a kind of philosophical way, he was not interested in being a Christian and couldn't understand why the Pākehā God would want to live in New Zealand. I mean, there were plenty of gods here, and the English God lived in England, and that was his place, and why would he want to be here? So it didn't really make any sense to Tuai or Te Tiri that they should bring this God here to New Zealand, especially if he was going to be higher than all the other gods and all the other gods of here. So they were quite interested in this idea, but rejecting of it. At the same time, not just saying, we don't want another God, what's the point? But the missionaries, of course, at the time were very keen to tell these young men, Tuai and Te Tiri, that they should come back to New Zealand and bring the Christian message, which involved a whole lot of cultural things, like you weren't allowed to fight, have tattoos, women weren't allowed to, or people weren't allowed to kill themselves, because that was quite common when partners died, when the husband died, the women would kill themselves. Weren't allowed to do a whole lot of things that were considered to be savage. And Tuai quite properly realised and basically, had a nervous breakdown over it, but realised that he couldn't come back to New Zealand at this time. And this was, you know, very early in the piece, when only very few Pākehā were in New Zealand, and basically tell his chiefs, his rangatira, oh, no, you can't do any of that. The ancestors, you know, our ancestors did it, but now we're going to all stop and be like English people. Mm. That was an impossibility. And so he found the missionary story about the superior God and that Māori ought to change, unacceptable to him. So this is a spoiler alert.
Oh, gosh.
When he got back to his home.
I've got to that point. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. He was really keen for Pākehā to come and live with his people, because Ngāpuhi and Hungihika had got...
Well, they talk about them like their Pākehā.
Yeah, that's right. They had got their Pākehā.
40 muskets.
like a shopping list.
Like sheep.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was beautiful.
So they needed their Pākehā in the south of the Bay of Islands, because Ngāpuhi had theirs in the northern Bay of Islands, the Ngāpuhi aligned hapū. So they needed to get a balance. But Samuel Marsden, who was in charge of the Pākehā at the time, coming here, the missionaries, he didn't let his Pākehā go down with Tuai. He said a second lot of Pākehā were to go with Hongihika. Mm. So, and that, paradoxically or not, meant the whole history of the North was decided at that moment, really, because it strengthened Hongihika to such an extent that Ngāpuhi gained this power in the North. And Ngāti Raumati, who were Tuai's people, were dispersed,
right?
And their stories haven't really been told.
Mm.
So the stories we mostly hear are stories, for example, about hongihika, honeheke, stories that are not of Tuwai's people.
Well, it is the thing, isn't it, that history is written by the victors, and so in this case, history is written by the people who got the upper hand at an early stage.
Yes, who made that relationship with the Pākehā.
What amazed me is that their insistence on stopping fighting, yet at the time, I think when he first left to go, it was about 1812, wasn't it, where the Napoleonic Wars were on. So it seemed a bit funny that the British were saying, don't fight, you savages. Oh, I'm just going to Europe to kill
you. That's amazing that they're hypocritical. I never knew that.
Yes, well, they learned a lot, Tuwai and Titiri, and also Hongihika, when he went over later, learned a lot about how to fight English style.
Right.
Each man has a gun.
Mm. Right.
Very good.
And maybe also about politicking and about how people say one thing and do another. And yeah, yeah. I'm interested in the idea that he went to find out strategy. What kind of things did he learn about how to handle a very different culture?
Well, I think that Māori at that time were extremely interested in the outside world. And he and others had travelled to Australia and also, in this case, to England. And they really wanted to learn about Pākehā technology. All aspects of Pākehā life were very fascinating.
Mm.
And they wanted to see the ariki, the king, the highest person of the Pākehā world that was coming down to this part of the world. And so they learnt a huge amount about English society.
Mm.
From food to clothing, they got a really big taste for certain kinds of foods. Tuwai got very fond of tea, so he liked to have a cup of tea when he got back.
Yeah, everyone loves
and, tea. And he also liked his European clothes, so he used to wear a jacket and trousers and a hat when he got back to New Zealand, when other Māori around him did not have those clothes.
Mm.
So he was a very interesting character, and we've got some pictures of him in amongst his people, dressed up in his English clothing.
Wow.
And they are all in their ordinary kākahu. So he was a fascinating kind of young man who came back between two worlds.
Yeah.
You know, he knew a lot about England, about the power of the British, and about a huge world that the people around him didn't know about or couldn't even imagine. But he was still part of that Māori world because he wasn't a very, high-up person. He was young, under his brother. So he was fascinating because he was probably the only Māori at that time who knew as much as he did and yet still existed within the traditional Māori world.
And they brought a lot of things back, didn't they? New tools and along with
crockery and glassware
and those sorts of things, butterflies.
Well, I thought that...
Sorry,
you handed that to me on a plate. Yeah, butterflies. Lovely segue there. To bring in Kavi Chitty to talk a little bit about the exhibition that's on at Auckland Museum at the moment.
Sure, and it actually just opened yesterday morning.
It's a brand new.
Brand new same morning,
Yep.
With breakfast and preschoolers.
Oh.
It was certainly an experience. It was a bit of a brush with stardom with Susie Cato.
Susie Cato came.
Did you get to meet her, did you?
Briefly, I did. Yeah. I did shy away.
Is she still on Dancing with the Stars?
That's right.
She once replied to a comment of mine on Facebook. So.
Did she?
Don't want to brag.
Are you her friend?
Yeah. Like this. Okay. Yeah, I'm crossing my fingers.
she was quite... She was lovely in the morning because when she introduced herself and she talked about herself, she said, you can go to see Katie's World, .susie.co.nz, and also 3333 if you're watching Dancing with the Stars.
Never miss a plug.
So the exhibition has been in development for about a year. But its history actually started with we were gifted a collection of 13,000 butterflies from a man called Ray Shannon. And that was about 10 years ago, and it's been in production since then, essentially.
Wow.
Our collection managers have been working really hard to get these butterflies in good shape to put on show and to make sure that they're going to be safe. And so the exhibition started with this idea of displaying this amazing collection, and then we grew it from there to kind of dive into interesting things about the life history of butterflies and what they eat and interesting facts and bits and pieces. And we also decided to target it at 5 to 8-year-olds and families.
Are they all dead butterflies?
They're all dead butterflies. So Ray started his collection during World War II, actually. He was serving in the Solomon Islands as a telecommunications engineer. And in his spare time, he would run around with a net catching butterflies. And we think that that's kind of where his obsession started, and it kept going for 70 years once he came back to New Zealand. He's even got a butterfly named after him, actually, in the British Natural History Museum.
Gosh.
Mynie's Woodford Shannoni.
Oh.
That's kind of the inception of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it's a family exhibition at the museum. Yeah.
It is really family-friendly. We took Molly, my 10-year-old daughter, and she was actually dancing at the opening. So it was quite good. We were there for two things. Mm-hmm. But self-promotion for my daughter's dance group, Body Puppies. And she was amazed by the butterflies and, you know, that sort of stuff. And I'm not a sciencey person. But I was amazed. The colour, the absolute depth of colour of these butterflies is beyond description.
It's quite stunning, right? Yeah. Like, some of them don't look real. Like, there's black and white ones, for example, look like they've just been cut out of paper. Wood.
I thought there were wooden ones.
That's right.
Yeah, the brown ones, yeah.
Yeah.
So they don't fade. I would have thought if you killed a butterfly and stuck it, you know, a pin through it, it would fade over time.
I definitely would.
They do fade if they're left out exposed to lots of sun. And so they're pretty much kept in really low light conditions because the pigment does fade. So they've just been looked after really well, to be honest, by Ray and now by our collection keepers.
And are you a butterfly person? Are you?
I think I've become a butterfly person.
What is it that you like about them?
Well, our entomologist, who's the curator on the show, John Early, just likes to describe them a bit dismissively as the tarts of the insect world.
The tarts.
That's what I thought you said.
But, you know, they're really quite these interesting, really robust, very, very specific animals. They tend to live their whole lives around one particular plant. And
which is a day, eh?
Sorry?
Their whole lives is like a day?
Well, for some, and then others could live up to 3 months, I think. So
it's
kind of like there's quite a huge diversity in butterflies. Me personally, I just like how they look so pretty and so fragile, but they're actually like kind of gnarly. There's butterflies. So butterflies, they need sugars and they need salts, and that's pretty much what they eat as adults after they change from caterpillars. And so they get that sugar and salt in very different ways. See, from flowers, and then they get the salts from mud and salty water, but then also from feces and urine. And then there's some that are so specific that they get their salts from the tears of a certain species of caiman crocodile.
I thought she was joking about
bizarre.
That.
Bizarre.
Crocodile.
Really?
There's a Julia butterfly in the Amazon, which literally dances on the eyes of these caimans.
Until
tears form, and then they drink them.
There must be some protein or something in there.
it's literally the salts from this salty crocodile tears.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they're from all around the world, the butterflies.
His collection was from Southeast Asia, the South Pacific, and South America. So that's the extent of the collection we're holding. Yeah.
Is there like nothing not magical about butterflies? Even the way they eat is like straight out of a fairy tale. It's stunning.
Is there anything not magical about butterflies? I'm not sure how to answer that. I mean, they do.
That's why I don't ask the question.
You can tell me whether this is magical or not. But they do one poo as an adult ever, and it's when they're first born, and it's a big sloppy red thing called a meconium.
I think I know people
Meconium
who are like
make
that.
Me go, Well, that's the coffee, isn't it?
No, that's close.
Yeah. Kona, sorry.
So that's the name of the baby's first poo, isn't it?
That's right,
So,
wow.
That's amazing.
I highly recommend, just for the visual aspect of it, just seeing the diversity of colour on that wall. I thought, butterflies, I've got to have a look. Just beautiful. And that's not even the collection, is it?
No. So we've got 2,000 on display at any one time. And we'll rotate through them, like as I said before, they can only deal with so much light, and so we have to rotate them.
Right.
So
yep.
It'll be on until June next year, and so over that time we'll be changing them out 3 times.
Okay. And are they stuck with pins, or are they?
They are.
nice decorative patterns.
They're a neat
color code, aren't they?
Color coded and
do you spell things with them.
No, it's set up with very rigid entomological and taxonomic groupings. So it's very fun for kids.
Yeah. I saw a kid go, well, these look like they're an entomological and taxonomic mummy.
The key messaging.
As he was creating his own digital butterfly, which was something that, you know, you can do. So
there's some interactive stuff to do as well?
That's
right. You can crawl through a caterpillar, can't you?
So we started with this... with this really cool mass display of butterflies, and then we've kind of dived out from there, and we've got a couple of digital interactives that allow you to explore the anatomy of a butterfly up close at about 40 times zoom, which actually looks super alien, which is, if you get to see anything, it's really, really cool. And also a giant digital wall, which is like a mini forest, and kids get to colour in their own butterflies
and
send them off into it.
And why? They've got really hairy faces?
They do. They actually are covered in scales all over their bodies, and they almost look like feathers. It's actually really, really cool. I mean,
well, this is really getting me into the idea of butterflies, isn't it? I never knew they were so fascinating.
They're not just things that eat the cabbage.
No.
But they do, yeah.
Because I don't actually think there's that wide a range of butterflies in New Zealand. Are you going to shout me down?
There's not the same diversity, I guess, you'd find in the Amazon or something like
the Solomons.
But the Solomons, but we do have quite a few, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. Dying to go to that exhibition.
Yes. Paula? Yeah, no, I am. I am going to head along to that. And I'm also dying to go to a couple of great shows that are coming up. If we can start off with maybe talking about A Gambler's Guide to Dying.
Absolutely. Where do you want to start?
Well, just...
I don't know, pick a number.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about where the show came from and how come you're putting it on here.
Well, it's actually pure luck that I even saw the show. I was in Edinburgh in 2015 when it premiered at the Traverse Theatre, which is one of the sort of most reputable sort of fringe venues. And it was written by Gary McNair, who is also a performer himself. He performs most of his own work. And show had sold out. Wasn't going to be able to go, and I had this early morning breakfast with someone and basically realised how desperately I needed to see this work and queued up for return tickets. And luck would have it, some poor person didn't make it to the show, but I was able to go in. And it's a beautiful, beautiful story about a boy's relationship with his grandfather and how that changes as he grows up and his grandfather is diagnosed with cancer.
So that's the guide to dying, is it?
Exactly, right. Yes. So his grandfather bets every week on the footies to see if he can win big, and won in 1966, won one other time since then, and then decides to introduce this wee boy at the age of 11 to the world of gambling.
Never too early.
Not at all, no. But it all sort of gets turned on his head with the cancer diagnosis. But it sort of picks up a gear when, rather than betting on the footies, the grandfather decides, no, I'm going to outlive my cancer diagnosis, and takes that bet to the bookies and bets, rather than 1 month, I'm going to live for two. But of course, a gambling addict can't stop there and ends up betting that he'll live to see the millennium.
Right. No spoilers.
None
not going to tell us.
No.
Yeah. So, it's a one-man show?
It's a one-man show.
And you are the one man in the show?
I am the one man. But no one-man show is ever just one man. I've got an incredible team of like six people behind me.
Do you want to tell us a bit about them?
Absolutely. Elizabeth Turner and Marianne Infante is my sort of production team and stage manager. I've got two Pauls, Paul Bennett and Paul McClaney, both responsible for light and sound respectively. And my director is the incomparable Jennifer Ward Leland.
Wow. And how was it working with her?
Fortunately, still going. Still working, still loving every moment of it. It's been an intense 3-week rehearsal period. A lot of shows at the basement tend to sort of have this long, drawn-out rehearsal period because of people's availability and the nature of full-time jobs as well as making art. But Jennifer's schedule and busy life meant that it was like, no, we need to make sure we keep this truncated, keep this short. So it's been 3 weeks, Monday to Friday.
Intense.
Intensive, yeah.
Sick leave for some of the people.
Is there sick leave? No, sick leave. No chance for that.
No, and they can ring up their real jobs and say, I'm just not doing very well.
Yeah, we probably shouldn't talk too much about sick leave. I've taken a fair bit of that.
You're not looking very well, John. So,
yeah, I'm very pale.
So have you done a one-person show before?
No, this is arguably the first show that I have, first straight play that I've done since I graduated back in 2014. Since then, I've been sort of doing immersive interactive work and a musical or two. But this is my first like text straight play, and my first time at the Basement as well in terms of as an actor. I've worked the box office there since I was like 17.
Oh wow!
But my first time actually there performing myself, which feels long overdue.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so, do you feel all the responsibilities on your shoulders?
Oh yeah, there's no one but me out there when it comes to the show performance.
Yeah.
I'm incredibly supported. By no means is it sort of. My shoulders are being lifted up by other people. But, yeah, sort of once those house lights go down and the audience starts to get quiet, then it's all on me to carry us through.
Yeah.
What happens if you forget your lines?
I'm not expecting that to happen. I'll have to make prompt. Them up is the short answer.
Do you have a prompt?
No, so I've got my stage manager in rehearsals, but I won't have that on the night. No, it's...
She'll be backstage, though, just in case, though, Adrian.
Exactly, yeah. She'll be understudying. She'll be learning the lines ready to go on if I break a leg.
Do you have to speak with a Scottish accent or
I
anything?
Do indeed, yes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So
can they do a Scottish accent?
I want to tell you about my granddad.
Oh.
He was a great man. Bad enough. I don't know if I'm allowed to say too much of
it's
the show.
It's a teaser.
We don't want to do the whole show.
No, we should
how
go
long
along.
Is the show?
It's a 70-minute show. It's a wee
we haven't
bit
got
of a,
time to get it all.
No,
yeah,
so. We'll have to come to the Basement Theatre.
Oh, nice. Yeah, and continuing the death theme.
Bom, bom, bom.
We've got Ben Moore here, who's the director of Dying to Meet You, which
That's
is
right.
a comedy.
Yeah. Well, it was actually originally put on at the Auckland Comedy Festival. And we were very lucky and we sold out and wanted to do a follow-on season so that we could hope more people come, I guess. Because we love the show and we love the message of the show and we really want to get it out to as many people as we can. And so we are on at Tapo this coming weekend, Friday and Saturday nights at 7:30. Ashton is insanely funny, so
this is Ashton Brown.
Ashton Brown, yeah.
And what is the message of the show?
Excuse me. What is the message of the show? Tough question, man. I guess to give a framework. Last year, we did a show called Ashton Brown is Anxious to Meet You, and with that show, it was all about trying to destigmatize mental health. Have a laugh about it because Ashton has unashamedly talked about his struggles with depression, anxiety, etc. And so we wanted to try and get the conversation happening so people didn't feel like they couldn't talk about it, which is a really big problem that's becoming more acknowledged now in New Zealand.
Mm.
So following on from that, he wrote his second show, Dying to Meet You, and that's all about facing death. Around the time when Ashton did Anxious to Meet You, the return season last year, his granddad died, and I also lost my stepdad last year. So we were both kind of confronted with the inevitability of the abyss. And so
you make it sound so fun.
Well, yeah, that's the plan, right? That's the plan, is to make it sound fun. So Ashton gets up and he tells a few stories about his experiences with death and how he's kind of learned to cope with the idea of it, which is a huge challenge for every human being. So is that the message of the show? Yeah, how to have fun with death.
Yeah, well, it is. I suppose that's one of the things, isn't it? It's quite a deep vein of comedy because it's a good way to actually try and deal with it, is to laugh about it.
Yeah, and this year it's actually a little bit more irreverent than last year, I think, because it's such a huge topic. You know, how do you not send it up? How do you not make it a bit more fun and more self-referential and entertaining?
And he does that.
He does that beautifully. Yeah. So in the process. So my involvement, for those people who go, how do you do a directing of a stand-up show? It's not a stand-up show, really. He does stand-up within it, but it's very little of it was actually performed before we performed it at the comedy festival. Ashton wrote it, like a loose outline. We got together, we workshopped it, we had fun with the jokes, and did what we could to create something that we found funny, and then we got it up on its feet, and I went through it and figured out the beats and how it all comes together. At the end of it, we just go, oh God, no one's going to like us, and panic until he performs, and then it all goes away and we have a good time. So we sold out last year, we sold out this year, so I can say without too much bias that it's a good show.
Yep, yeah. Sounds it. Can't wait. Now, we're just going to take a wee break and hear a piece of music that I've chosen that is about butterflies.
Oh,
and yeah,
butterflies.
Nice. Funny that.
It's not about deer.
Yeah, wish you had. There's plenty of those, I tell you. Can I just say, before you do that, speaking of death, I've just purchased on vinyl David Bowie's Black Star album.
Mm, awesome.
And it just... he knew he was going to die. He wrote a musical about it, pretty much. And it's just superb.
You
And so then he just walked out of the room, and that was it. And so, you know, it was a good album, though. I really enjoyed it. Oh, so you can play the song now, Paula.
Oh, thanks, Richard, for that.
Yeah.
That was Grimes with Butterflies.
Oh, you've already played? Oh.
Yeah, okay. Sorry. Yeah.
That's right.
I just had a little snooze, and now I've come back.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
All right. So what should we talk about?
Well, Grimes.
Oh, I don't even know. She's going out with Elon Musk, apparently.
Well, this is what I'm hearing.
It's true. Twitter knows all about it.
Well, he's a multimillionaire.
I don't know who Elon Musk is, but so far I've been told he's the owner of Tesla.
It blows my mind you don't know who Elon Musk is.
Yeah, I'm pretty surprised. I mean, even I know who Elon Musk is.
But I'm not a name person. I'm a face person. So, okay. You know, I've read about him. I know he makes electric cars that I can't afford
to
buy.
He fell out with Trump. So that's something in his favour.
I think Trump's losing people every day, isn't he? He's
falling out. Well, so. Yeah, certainly the G7. Yeah. He's lost all them.
It's going to be G1 very soon.
I know.
Or G6.
G6.
Take your pick.
Hopefully it'll be a G6. That's what I'll be.
Anyway, let's talk about art.
Oh, okay.
Stay away from politics.
Yes. Yeah, if nothing else.
It's intricately involved, though, isn't it, really?
Mm, absolutely.
Oh, how so, Richard?
Well, just everything you do is political, to quote Nandor Tajos from 2002.
Oh, right.
And I think it's quite, art has a lot of political... A lot about politics. I mean, the book Tuoi talks about the politics in the Bay of Islands. I was amazed at how fragmented it was up there with the hapu and stuff.
Yeah, so I think people kind of assume that Māori are Māori. You know, it's just one group of people. When I say people assume, Pākehā people assume that. But you realise, you know, when you get closer to the Māori world, and particularly if you do any historical reading or writing, that Māori are very much a tribal-based
Absolutely.
Group. And hapu were, you know, that's what New Zealand was. Mm. And it was really just the fact that Europeans came here and the attempts at colonisation, you know, that were early, that forced Māori hapu and rangatira and different tribal groups to actually work together.
Mm. But isn't that also the way
entirely different
that
from
you,
what they were?
That you can... emphasise divisions and you can create alliances and get power is that people did have their long-held alliances and grievances.
Well, I suppose it's just like all the clans
they exploited
in Europe,
it.
You know, the same kind of thing.
Well, I thought about when reading about Irish history and they were very clannish and that was one of the things that the English did was go and exploit the different clans and, you know, it was divide and conquer. Really, and they have this similar relationship to the land. You know, reading about it, I thought that sounds very like Māori.
I found interesting is that the word Māori doesn't describe an ethnic group. It actually means ordinary and normal. So it was they
I thought it was like person.
Māori,
it's like human.
They were describing themselves as being a normal person,
yeah.
As opposed to being a rangatira or a tūhunga
a
or
god,
something like that. Yeah. So it was I am
Māori. He tangata Māori aho. I'm a human being.
I'm just an ordinary person. Yeah, yeah. So
yeah.
But Pākehā adopted it as the term, they must all be Māori, must be all one people. So, yes, just like all the butterflies. Yeah. We're all very different, aren't we?
Absolutely.
Yeah, what's political about butterflies?
There is
weird like gender associations when people talk about butterflies, and they assume that, you know, that there's a feminine aspect to butterflies, and
well,
I think that's quite interesting.
Of the insect world.
Well,
that,
yeah,
that sounds pretty female.
Tart of the insect.
But there's got to be boy butterflies, haven't there?
There certainly are. Yeah, but yeah. There's like so many weird things. Once you start, it's like these things. You start scratching the surface, and then there's things about like these male butterflies getting drunk on rotten fruit, fermented fruit, and fighting. Like, no. It's something you can connect with. I think
something you can identify with.
Well, not that we know of, apparently. Yeah,
really.
I don't know what they said. I don't know.
Is it only the males who do that?
Apparently in this case.
Oh,
they're
no.
Fighting over mates.
How can you tell the difference between the male and the female butterflies?
Because the males are fighting and getting drunk.
No, it's often very, very subtle pattern differences, is my understanding, even just in the wing shape as well. But again, my understanding is fairly limited of the anatomy, unfortunately, yeah.
But it sounds like it's caught your interest, hasn't it?
That's one of the cool things about my job in general, I think, is that it's like you get to dive into something that you otherwise would just be skirting. And so, yeah, it really has caught my attention.
Hmm.
And also just thinking about stuff from a scientific perspective, but for a really young audience, it really makes you consider your own understanding of concepts and how are you really understanding what you're reading if you've then got to distill it down for an 8-year-old or a 5-year-old where you can't rely on text or someone else.
Or Richard.
Yeah. So what actually is your job then? So your role is, are you a curator?
No, so my role is a content and interpretation developer, which is a long way. Yeah.
So you're a curator.
My job is to work with the curator. Right. So we work as a team. And they, if this is the way I try to describe it, is that if something goes wrong with the content of the show and we say something's one thing but it's actually another thing or it's inaccurate, then it's on them. If the show doesn't work for the audience we're targeting it at and if people don't get it, then that's on me.
Right.
And so my job is to kind of like get those concepts and then find really interesting ways and really fun ways to make that speak to the people we're trying to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
the interactive stuff, that those ideas come from you?
Things that
the kids can get involved?
Myself and my colleague Esther Tobin, who I was on the show, I think, a couple of months ago for a different show. So we come up with the concept for how we're going to deliver these things. And then a lot of our job's writing creative briefs for much more talented people to deliver on.
Mm.
And then to kind of, guide that process, I guess. Yeah,
you're the creative originator, aren't you, of it then? So that's quite a... saying you're passing on to more creative people, maybe implementers, are you a...
More talented people, I guess, with the digital creators and artists and 3D designers and people with more specific skill sets, I guess. I don't know how to describe that. Yeah.
You're the big vision thinker.
Yes, I guess so, yeah. Brief writer.
So, John and Ben, what do you think about art as politics? Discuss.
Wow, big question. Yeah.
Fight over a rotten fruit.
I think it's very important that everybody in the community, in the society, has their say. And I sometimes think that it's not always easy for people to speak up to the top, and art can be a very powerful way to do that. It's also an interesting way to explore possibilities as well. Mm. I think to look at what if and try and think about how we could go about resolving issues before they come up.
Mm.
So I do think there's a powerful part.
Well, I'm thinking of the last show that was focusing on mental health that you did with Ashton. You can see how that may have been an eye opener for a number of people who went along.
I hope so. Yeah, I do hope so.
Did you get any feedback?
The audience were very appreciative. They really, really enjoyed it. I had some really great reviews as well.
Do you read reviews?
I read them when Ashton sends them to me as soon as they come out, yeah.
With his name underlined.
Yeah. So there have been some good reviews and some really good feedback about it, and some people just coming up and saying to Ashton, mostly because I stand in the corner, thank you so much for talking about this, because it's made me feel so much better about, you know, me living with what I'm living with.
Yeah. And so it's still very taboo, isn't it?
It is very taboo, and I try to make a habit of I live with an anxiety disorder, you know, it's difficult, but it's not life, it's not debilitating, and I try to talk about it openly because I think that it should be an interesting part of my personality. Mm. And if people want to ask me about it, I'm happy to talk about it, because stigma is such a powerful thing and such a really, it can really affect people very harshly. So when I get to be part of something that is so exciting and is just sending a good message, we may not change everything, but if we change 5 people's mind from being finding it really difficult to go and talk to somebody, and they go see their GP, like, that's awesome. That's really, really, really cool.
Mm.
Yeah, so I think it's a powerful, powerful platform for those who want to speak.
Mm. Comedy's a good platform, isn't it, to have these conversations, because people are laughing and learning and...
At the same time.
The barrier's down.
Yeah, exactly. Indian Ink, fond of saying... make them laugh to open their mouth and then slip something important in. I'm paraphrasing, but I've always really liked that.
Yeah.
Like food.
Yeah, like food, yeah. So it's always and being behind the scenes as well, and being part of the creative process, it's very learning for me as well. Trying to, like you say, when you have to think about how to explain something to somebody, you have to reflect on it and really think about it and analyze it and distill it. So has been very beneficial for me and Ashton as well, and hopefully everyone who comes to see it.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, it sounds like it.
At Topo, 7:30 Friday.
Yeah. Friday. Don't worry, we'll get to all that.
A shameless promotion at the end.
Well, Sean.
I'm following your lead, Richard.
Yeah. Right.
I think there's something incredibly holistic about the arts, and I think that's kind of like politics as a vehicle of something that's meant to be serving the people, is meant to be for our betterment in all manner of life. I just think it is such a beacon right now, particularly with our Prime Minister being the Minister of the Arts.
Mm. Is she a mother yet?
Any minute now.
Who's
literally.
Due this weekend, I think, wasn't it?
Is it?
Yeah.
Watch the Sky Tower, I guarantee they'll light it up.
Oh, really? So exciting.
Which will really annoy me. Yeah.
Oh, no,
yeah.
Please don't do that at all. Let's go gender neutral.
Yeah.
Sorry, carry on, John.
Sorry.
Oh, where was it? But, yeah, that's that thing that if everything is serving us having a better quality of life, and whether that is dealing with issues that are political, whether that's how different conflicts come about between different groups of people, or whether that's how we deal with our own mortality. Mm. I think that's, like, it's impossible to remove art from the context it exists in, just like politics is, like systemic of the culture that it exists in, which I don't want to dive into at all. but it is that thing of it's about that journey of if this is making something better or if this is bringing awareness to someone about something for themselves, that is, like, just not even a small step for a wider group of people, that is a leap in someone's life.
Mm-hmm.
For me, this, like A Gambler's Guide to Dying, it's you hear the story from the viewpoint of the narrator, who is the boy years on from his grandfather's death. And for me, in many respects, it is a man dealing with a boy's grief, something that he hasn't necessarily entirely processed when he was young. My grandfather died when I was 10, 11, and it was a similar sort of process, realising that the version of my grandfather I have in my head versus his journey into cancer, and my memories of that are something that is so hard to sort of correlate now with how I have sort of this sense of mortality and life and death, and it's also made me incredibly aware of how poorly men are taught to deal with grief.
Right.
And that is a societal, political problem that is being raised to the fore more and more, is we're taught to be strong, to not cry, to not process these things. Exactly. Mm. And that's very much difficult to do, to break through that and to accept, no, actually, I can be vulnerable and there is strength in that vulnerability.
And it's a wonderful story, and just to link that to Tuai, there's an amazing story. When Tuai came back from England, one of the things he was fascinated in was sort of forms of masculinity, if I can put it like that. Of course, he wouldn't articulate it like that. Mm. But he was determined he was going to be like an Englishman, and he wasn't going to cry. And one of the things that's very characteristic of traditional Māori society, particularly in the north and probably other places, mm-hmm. but from what we had read about the past, is that men would cry a lot. And especially when greeting each other over long after being away from each other, sometimes they'd stand with a hongi or their faces together for half an hour at a time, just with tears, crying. And there's this amazing scene that was described where Tuai was standing there with his brother, and these people were coming to see towards them, and they hadn't seen him for 2 years. And he was standing there saying to the missionary standing next to him, I'm not going to cry, I'm not going to cry. And they coming towards him wailing and greeting and crying, and his brother started to greet him and cry, and he just couldn't stop himself from crying, and he engaged in a lot of crying. And it was just such a poignant scene, because you could see that he wanted to kind of impress his new Pākehā friends that he was this staunch man, you know, his idea of manliness, and
The stiff upper lip.
It still came to him that this was his kind of natural, if you like, natural response was this kind of melting, you know, an emotional melting, which was incredible.
Where does that British stiff upper lip kind of come from? In that,
is it I think it's public schools. No, I don't. I think it's a public school system.
Which would be private here.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I was amazed by that part of the book as well. It was fascinating to see how they recorded how emotional Māori men were with each other and with their families and everything. And the crying was, you know, the wailing, the tangi was constant, you know. Happiness, sadness, you expressed your emotions so readily. So there's just another form of cultural colonisation, essentially, isn't it? Because he was told by the missionaries not to cry. It wasn't something that men did. He was trying to fight against
that. So you're getting a particular view of masculinity, aren't you?
Well, it's a control of emotion, isn't it? If you control emotion, you can control other people too, and you can get them to fight in certain sorts of ways, hideous ways, without their emotions being involved. Whereas even if you look at the way that Māori fought, if you look at the stories from this book, the process of fighting and killing somebody is deeply spiritual and deeply organised. You know, you don't just stand, talking about death, you don't just stand back and shoot people from a distance. Well, that's what happened, of course, after everybody got muskets. But before everybody had muskets, if you're going
to
fight someone and kill them, you're doing it face-to-face, literally. And people would know they're going to die, and that moment of death is sometimes incredibly ritualised, and you'd have to have a certain person of a certain rank to kill a person of a high rank, because that in itself would be an important moment. And so a huge amount of sort of emotion, spirit, you know, everything comes together in that moment in a way that if you've got a kind of a form of masculinity that is emotionally cut back, then you can do all sorts of things to people from a distance and in huge numbers, which, you know, and you can control the soldiers, can't you, if you keep them. They don't want them blubbering, crying, but, you know, on the battlefield.
Sure.
And yet in other cultural situations, the crying, the shouting, the screaming, the haka, you know, this kind of huge amount of energy is all about emotion. It builds you up to a point where you can actually have these incredible engagements with other people that...
I mean, I remember being on holiday in Greece when, on this little island, two of the local boys who were like teenagers had been killed on motorbikes. And we were just passing the graveyard at the time that they were burying these boys. And it was quite a way away, but you could hear all the women wailing. And I just immediately connects. You know, you don't know these boys, but... And that's what it is. It's when there's an expression of emotion, it connects us as human beings and makes, obviously, some things more difficult to do, like be aggressive to one another.
I find that the whole, you know, just reading about the tangi and stuff and the death ritual and things, how in Western society I find it so... what's the word? It's so quick. You know, you go to a funeral at 2 o'clock and it's all over. And whereas a lot of societies, you know, they spend a week grieving, or, you know, they wrap them and they celebrate or they wake or whatever. And it's a different process, different cultural process. And not no one is any better than the other, but they're just very different.
It's probably being in bigger communities, having such big communities, and so privacy changes in that situation, I suppose, doesn't it? Where being in a much more close-knit community, it's very possible that the Māori people were much more involved in each other's lives rather than us don't-know-your-neighbour types. So it's kind of a beautiful thing to have a whole community come together to talk about.
I wonder when that changed, eh? When Western society, tribal society went to, well, I suppose, the cities, the Industrial Revolution, that must have done it, really.
But then you're doing the collective thing, you know, by having stand-up or theatre, talking about engaging with death. You kind of, there's an element of collectivity and social engagement there that might not be around an actual body, but it's actually around the whole, all the processes that that Pākehā society finds so difficult to deal with.
And you think of the beginnings of theatre being catharsis and ritual, and you're kind of bringing it back you know, every time you're looking at taboos, which death is, isn't it? Where people have talked about us having a death-denying society, then, you know, you making it a theatre show and getting people to come along kind of brings it out into the open, which is something that you were talking about, weren't you? Making things more visible.
Can I ask Alison a question, please?
Yes, of course, host. Richard.
Alison, I'm just curious why you chose the subject, you and your fellow...
Good question.
Chose the subject of Tuahi, because he's not well known. I mean, that could be one of the reasons, but what led you on that path to even start the project?
Well, I'm an academic, and I met Kuni when she was a student. She's from Ngāti Porou, actually, and this book is up north, so she's from around the east, and I'm a Pākehā, and us went up north to do this research on the people up north, which was a bit funny. But I met her when she was a student, and I supervised her PhD, and her PhD was really interesting because she wanted to know about the first school in New Zealand, the first Pākehā school. The first school, yes. So not like the traditional wānanga, but the school as a kind of cultural ritual of learning to read and write in a building, you know, sitting in lines kind of thing. When does that start in New Zealand, and how come Māori actually went? Because the first school had all Māori kids in it. It was taught in Māori. And so she was very curious about how did the first school eventuate. And she did some research on that, and I was supervising her PhD, and I said, hey, there's a book here. This is really fascinating, because it was all about Māori going to Australia to find a teacher to come and teach the children to read and write. So it was a kind of active Māori desire for literacy, because Māori didn't have a written language before that time. And so a Pākehā school teacher was sent here, and he did open a school amongst the Ngāpuhi aligned people in 1816. But the interesting thing was that in order to have a teacher to teach the children to read and write, which is what the chiefs wanted in the north, that school teacher who came from England had to learn Māori, of course. And so how did he do that? Well, when he was in Australia, Tuahi happened to be living in Australia at the time, as a number of Māori men did. And this is, you know, we're talking from 1805 to 1815, that period. And he lived with the Kendall family. It was Thomas Kendall who was the first school teacher in New Zealand. And Tuahi lived with their family in Parramatta, in near Sydney. And he taught Kendall to speak Māori. And so Kendall started to write the language down phonetically, being taught by Tuahi. And so Kendall was the author of the very first New Zealand Māori book.
Phrase book, wasn't it?
It was a phrase book, just a school book to teach the children to read and write. It was published in Sydney in 1815. And Tuahi was the interesting guy that was involved in this teaching process. So when we wrote our first book was on how the first school came to be, and how and why Māori engaged with reading and writing. And we found this character, Tuahi, who was, and sometimes called Tui or Tuhi, in all these stories, but he was always sort of in the footnotes. So if you look at any histories of the Bay of Islands of that early period, you'll find him, but he's usually in footnotes or just in passing. Mm. Oh, yes, well, Tui or Tuahi taught Kendall to read and to speak Māori, or Tuahi did this or Tuahi did that. Just in passing, I thought, well, who is this guy? And so we actually started to find so much material on him that we had to, he had to have his own book. Mm-hmm. And of course we say he wanted his own book. So
he was quite a he was quite a self-promoter in a way, wasn't he? He quite liked the clothes and the dandiness and stuff.
Yeah, he was interested in the world. Mm-hmm. He was interested in the wide world. Yeah.
Two interesting facts. Māori had the highest rate of literacy in their own language in the 1830s, and also in 1867 with the Native Schools Act, Māori became a language not of instruction. It was English only. And that lasted until the 1970s.
So that meant that you couldn't have any teaching in Māori?
No teaching in Māori. If Hapu wanted a school on their land, they had to provide the land, half the cost of the buildings, half the cost of the teacher, and the instruction was in English. That was the Native Schools Act.
And you weren't allowed to speak Māori in school?
No. And up into the 50s and 60s, people were wrapped on the knuckles for speaking Te Reo Māori in schools.
Well, my mum wasn't allowed to speak Gaelic at school.
It's the
so
same,
it's the same process.
I think that it's really complicated, and I think that too many people see it in very simplistic terms, that Māori was kind of beaten out of Māori language was beaten out of Māori kids, and I think that's a really unfair and unreasonable way to look at it, because at the time, Māori were largely, by this stage, a very rural people, and the work and what was happening in cities was, you know, in terms of, in towns in New Zealand with Pākehā, was developing. And Māori did want to, young Māori particularly, wanted to get jobs and to live in the towns, but they were finding it very difficult to do that because they didn't have any literacy and they didn't have the English. So there was a real push amongst Māori too. It's not just Pākehā's going and doing it to Māori. There's a push in the villages to say, okay, we'll teach the children to read and write in English in the schools. So at home, they'd have their Māori, and at schools, they would have English, so they'd become bilingual. Now, it seems to me to be, you know, a very, very sensible thing to do, if you look at it from a Māori point of view, and a Pākehā point of view, which may
I can't
have other
look at
motives.
It from a Māori point of view, because I'm not Māori, but I would...
So the all I'm saying is that what happened then was the parents started to lose their ability, and you see it happening right now in the islands. In the Pacific Islands, there are some, I know, Samoan families where the young child only speaks English, the mother speaks some Samoan, the grandmother speaks fluent Samoan. And this is happening all the time because people want their kids to do well in the modern society. So they start modifying their home life in order to support the kids to do well at school.
I'm talking about the 1860s, not the 1960s, though. When the law said you weren't allowed to speak Māori in schools. It was actually the law, which is a different thing to people choosing to learn English when it's actually legislated against, and that's the I suppose that's a different thing. That's because that's not a choice for Māori to do that.
I guess what I want to encourage people to do is to think in more complex ways about it, and not see it as simply a black and white question. Because Māori were actively involved in having kids not speaking Māori in schools. It wasn't just a Pākehā rule.
Cool to have narratives like Tuai's coming to the fore, because it does present that more complicated picture. And you can have these figures that aren't just 2D. And you could say that, I obviously haven't read the book, but, you know, maybe he was a bit of an asshole, or, you know, maybe he was actually really arrogant, but he was also really intelligent. And I'm digging into this at the moment, doing some research on a new show as part of the 250 years endeavour landing, and learning about new people like that we all should know about, like a figure like Tupaia, the Polynesian navigator. And I love the fact that as you're reading these accounts, you're kind of building this more complex picture of Māori as a people and what they wanted out of this interaction. It wasn't so much just an imposition, but more like they saw opportunities.
Absolutely.
They were very wily, and they were like, okay, if I'm friends with these guys, I can get guns, and I can kill those guys. Or, you know, we get the upper hand and we could trade. And so
carbohydrates, that was the other thing I remember. There was kind of a myth that the Māori were very attracted to Europeans, you know, all these pasty Englishmen. And in fact, you know, the intermarriage was often because there was only one source of carbohydrate. You're looking very quizzical about this, which was coumarin. It was very difficult to cultivate, and so they were trading to get different forms of carbohydrate, like potatoes and turnips.
Well, Māori were trading from the late 1700s, you know, so to Australia and things. So it was, you know, they were really, as you said, I don't know if Māori is the word.
Early 1800s.
Entrepreneurial.
Yeah, and they were very, entrepreneurial and...
Sorry, Wiley was a strange word.
Yeah, no, I was trying to work... Because I could think of Wiley E. Coyote from the Roadrunner cartoons, that's it.
Sure.
But they were clever, very clever traders and very astute.
That's right.
So, and that was, you know, in the 1830s, setting up the dairy factories and boat building and those sorts of things, because they saw the business opportunities. That was that's the thing that I think a lot of people don't realise. And your book highlights that Māori were travelling internationally a lot earlier than we thought. So, yeah, it was quite fascinating. But did butterflies travel much?
Yeah, they do actually. So,
Do they swarm travel over Australia? Like, does one go from one country to another, or
The biggest butterfly migration is that of monarchs across North America, from Mexico to the top of North America. That's a huge journey, and they actually do it over multiple generations, which is actually quite crazy. But in New Zealand, we have a kind of assisted migration, maybe, from Australia. They're flying down from the north to the south, and as they go along, the winds push them off course, and they kind of keep going, and they land in Bombay Hills after leaving Brisbane or something like that. So,
wow.
And so they can make this journey, you know, assisted in the jet streams and stuff. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, these tiny little guys, they do it, yeah.
By accident.
By accident.
That must be terrifying.
Yeah. Turning up in the bomb base. Yeah.
That's terrifying anyway.
I got him in Brisbane. Yeah, so also lots of birds in New Zealand as well have kind of introduced themselves from the east coast of Australia.
So,
What's your journey then to be? What you're not a curator, you're an innovative
content interpretation developer.
How does one become that? I mean, at school, did you say, when I grow up, I want to work at a museum as a content...
Because it sounds like a cool job.
It does.
It was a really fun job. I think I always had a soft spot for museums. I grew up, my grandfather raised me and my cousins, and we spent pretty much every second weekend at the museum. And that's part of the way we socialised and learnt.
At Auckland Museum?
No, I was born in South Africa, actually. I did my own migration. Until I was 8 years old and then moved to New Zealand. And Auckland Museum was actually one of the first places I got my bearings for New Zealand. So it actually, you know, it's a perfect thing to use in as an interview pitch. Mm. And it worked.
What does that mean?
I got my orientation as a migrant by going to Auckland Museum and learning a lot about the country.
That's funny because I did too, but it was similar. Yeah, I remember we came over for a trip and I stood outside Auckland Museum and I panned a big panorama of Auckland from... And when I got back to London, I got the photos developed because it was the old days, pre-digital, and put it above my desk and said, we're going to move there. Yeah,
so, there's a volcano.
Yeah.
There's a volcano.
And there's a volcano.
And that one's active and that one's active. Right. And, yeah.
So you hung out a lot in museums.
No, well, I was 8 years old. And I tried really, really hard to fit in as well.
Yeah.
Got teased mercilessly by my South African cousins and then my Kiwi friends as well. So eventually they beat it out of me.
What do you study to be a kind of a content and a guy?
Exhibition developers.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, shortcut, okay. Right.
ED.
ED. Growing up, always interested in science, always interested in arts. I could never choose... I studied drama and English and also biology and chemistry, and I didn't want to stop doing both. And so when I went to university, I studied zoology and visual arts.
Wow, what a combination.
Yeah, I just didn't know.
Could you just put that together yourself, or was there a degree?
It's a BA, BSc. It's like a double degree.
Right.
So content. You do them at the same time. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So it takes an extra year. But you do 2 degrees at the same time, essentially.
Wow.
I did that, and then I still didn't know what I wanted to do, and found out that there was a master's course at Otago in natural history filmmaking, and that was something that I was, you know, always wanted, you know, watching National Geographic growing up and stuff, and so it's just Serengeti, lion stalking. and so that picture was still stuck in my heart. I really wanted to do that. I applied for the filmmaking stream of this master's and I didn't get it, but I was offered a place in the writing and general kind of... it's called popularizing science, but it's, you know, it's all other applications of how you can engage people with science, I guess, other avenues of talking about science. That was it. Essentially, I did a master's in that, and then I ended up studying... Sounds really bizarre, Eric, see, but the newspaper coverage of climate change. At the time, there was the whole thing of the climate, the Paris Accord and Copenhagen, and it was all very much in the news. And we were really interested around what was actually shaping people's opinions about something so specific and quite, you know, high-level science concept like climate change, yet everyone kind of had an opinion and it's a hoax or it's not a hoax. And so we were really interested in that. And anyway, so that's what I did my master's in. And through that, ended up working in... But I was in Wellington doing public relations, essentially.
Yep.
Because what do you do when you learn about how to change how people form their opinions?
You're going to PR.
You're going to PR.
Yep.
hey, it was a global financial crisis time. You know, I needed work.
You don't have to.
There weren't a lot of ED positions going in museums at the time.
No. But it ended up being a great stepping stone. I learnt a lot about just the kind of more, you know, mercenary parts of writing and being creative for a job. And then I did that for about 4 years and then went overseas for a bit for a holiday, got a job at Auckland Zoo.
Butterflies?
as an interpretation coordinator. So again, so it's all about making people care about the animals in front of you, essentially. You know, it's like, so you've got a lion in front of you, then what? You know, so it was all about that level of things. And so working on some exhibition design through that. And then, yeah, and then the museum job came up and I was like, wow, this exists. Cool. And so that's kind of what it's been like. It's right. Like every step is like, what, oh, that exists. Cool, yeah. I'll do that. And so, yeah.
It's amazing how many interesting jobs are out there that we don't even know
about.
We
don't even know about. Now I'm very curious for my 16-year-old.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. I'll give you a ring.
Drop
talk
me
some more, yeah.
Please I do. Love that idea actually on education. We're current, like, just Sir Ken Robinson is this incredible thinker as far as education, how that is an industrialized system that we're trying to make work in a modern world that is no longer working in the same way. Mm. And we're legitimately trying to educate people for jobs that do not exist
right now.
And how do you train someone to do that? And ultimately that is creativity, that is engaging with people's imaginations, curiosity, looking for different types of connection, because the connections that we have from that industrial system don't work now.
No. And also I saw emotional intelligence, so the people who can actually relate to people are going to do okay.
What?
Okay.
Can I ask Alice another? Oh, you're going to ask a question. You go
no,
first.
Go ahead. You go first. You know, you're the boss.
Okay. No, I'm not. I'm just the co-host.
The wingman.
The wingman. They call, what was that movie, Top Gun? What was the name of the wingman in that?
You know, they're making another Top Gun.
I know. Don't get me started. Alison, as an academic, have you seen education change as your time as an academic? You know, the way that people are approaching, perhaps choosing degrees, like, you know, the degree that Navid's done and how it was something he didn't know was existed and stuff. Is that...
Oh, you mean at university?
Yeah, university, isn't it? You know.
Oh, yes, hugely. Yeah, I mean, I've been around the traps at university for 35 years now.
Wow.
And, you know, I got attracted to being at university because it was a kind of romantic life. You know, you could have your mates talking about really interesting intellectual things and kind of, you know, being really groovy. And now all I see is students as kind of ants at the University of Auckland anyway, you know, sort of trying to...
Ants with no library.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Let's keep it light.
You have to bring politics into it, don't you? But, I mean, I suppose I feel really sorry for the students compared with when I was at university. I mean, you know, not only did I not have to pay, in fact, I was paid, really. You know, we used to get those bursaries.
Yeah.
We got, you know, the $120 for an A bursary. I think we got that for 3 years. And would you believe, at that time when I was getting $120 a year, my board was $10 a week. That was $6 for the room and $4 for food, or the other way around. But that was $10 a week for my
That's
board.
Amazing.
When I first started at university.
Good old days. Paid for already, wasn't it?
I know, it's pretty amazing. But yeah, no, I've seen a huge change. Mm. And now people see the university degree as sort of how to get a job, and often being, as you say, kind of coming out of there feeling, okay, I've got my degree, now what's going to be the job, and is there a relationship between the degree and the job? And there's all kinds of really complicated things going on. I think that's I was interested in what you had to say, because it seems to me the work that you're doing, you guys are doing in terms of, you know, performance, that is one of, you know, where a lot of the education, if you like, actually occurs. So people are doing a lot of learning and teaching for really complex thing, you know, ways of being for the modern world, in a way that kind of teaching in a more traditional sense can't do. But we're still very much stuck in the lecture theatre mode. Mm. And I'm really quite surprised. I prefer the lecture theatre mode for myself as a teacher than the, online teaching. But I can see that young people, I mean, why would they come into a lecture? Why would they get on a bus? Why would they get in a car, come down the motorway, have to park it?
Get
Do they have
bed.
A car anyway?
Yeah.
What?
Get out of bed.
Get out of bed.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean... And you can make, I mean, people like Ken Robinson and others, you know, they're incredible the way they teach in those digital ways. Mm. And I still think we haven't made that shift in a really powerfully positive way rather than another kind of ant-like way, you know. Mm. Here's a box,
tick this one. I'm still amazed that at school they do their exams on pen and paper.
Hooray, yeah. I'm pleased.
Well, I'm not, because they spend all their time typing on computers. So some of them are actually failing because they can't actually write quick enough.
I'm actually
in
surprised
an exam.
They still do exams, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, but they're done in such an old-fashioned way.
Mm. Well, that's back to the industrial thing, and that's the sort of the idea of if we're training people to do a test, then we're training people all on the same stock standard measurement of well they can do something. So how well can this fish climb a tree? Let's find out.
Yeah.
And people in the arts often don't fit the tree ladder. pick up from what you said about the fish, but you know, people in the arts aren't the people that are going to fit into that stock standard.
But they do have a lot of flexibility, don't they? Because they have to, and that goes along with the creativity. Because I was thinking about, you know, how my brother-in-law has just retired after being in the same job for 34 years.
Oh, gosh.
But that's really who can ever think about doing that or would want to do it, actually? Oh, apart from you, sorry. But, you know, in the future, I would imagine that people will have to be a lot more proactive and a lot more flexible.
I think it's a very middle-class thing, though, isn't it? Because you still have people who have to work. It's a very... the perspective is, if you're educated or whatever, you can go and choose your job. But actually, there are a lot of people who don't get to choose the hours they work, whether they can do it online. They actually have to. You know, I see people in cafes the day and go, what's your job? You know, I do that myself. But you know, often people have to get up, they have to go to work, they have to clock in, they have to clock out. Their boss is an ass, you know, that kind of thing. And they don't get to go, well, actually, today I'm going to work from home.
Sure.
And a lot of my contemporaries go, I'm going to work from home today because I can, you know, and not everyone has that luxury.
But Richard, curiously also, you know, talk about creativity and difference. I've found over the 35 years I've been an academic is that they have, you know, systematically, I guess, from the university scene, and maybe this is also in terms of teaching in secondary schools, have bleached out any eccentricity, any difference from the teachers. So you used to have teachers who were drunks, who were kind of mad people, who were funny, who would dress up in weird clothes, who were just off the wall, you know. And we'd all go, oh, silly old so-and-so, and they go, oh, drunk old so-and-so, you know. and we're just not allowed to be that anymore.
Yeah. No, it's
corporatized, isn't it? We all have to be absolutely straight down the line, and we've got to obey the rules. And
I actually did teach secondary for 4 years, and what I noticed in the system was so bad with this microphone. What I did notice being in the system was that it was quite bureaucratic, which. It becomes very much an administration job.
Mm.
And I think when you start trying to take people who are by nature sociable, creative, inspiring people and turn them into administrators, you compromise.
Mm.
So that's something that I struggled with a lot. But in saying that, there are, I just do want to say, have a shout out while we have this conversation to all the amazing teachers out there who do amazing stuff.
Yes.
So many amazing people in the system who are trying so hard to change things and make things more modern and better and exciting.
They say often it comes from the top, you know, change comes from the top. And I was at Western Springs College a couple of weeks ago when Cindy was there, you know, our Prime Minister Cindy. and she spoke to a group of students and she said, you know, do what you love, not what you think you should do to get a job. And everything else will be okay. And she talked about how she'd failed a fifth form exam and she thought her life was over. But actually, she said, after 2 years of leaving high school, no one cared about the fact I failed fifth form statistics. So, you know, it's... And she told this... It was such a great thing for a prime minister to stand up and go, do what you love to do. Don't think about, you know, my job. Think about what you love and then everything else will happen. And that is inspiring speech. From somebody who's in that position, you know.
I gotta say, like, I had that speech. My mum was a teacher as well, a high school teacher, and then a guidance counselor. And that speech was very much ingrained into me, like, do what you love and don't chase a career. But then, obviously, I finished university and, like I said, it was the global financial crisis time. There were no jobs for graduates anywhere. I was going for a job and there was something like 60 PhDs going for this job for, like, a $32,000 salary.
Jeez.
And so at that time, much? You know, the idea that... that, you know, oh, I should have been chasing, maybe I should have been looking at a trade, maybe I should have been looking at becoming an accountant or a computer programmer or something like that. I think I totally get that sentiment and why it's good, I think, and it would be good for a lot of people, and it turned out great for me. But I think also it's kind of like, that's not always the economic reality, you know, of maybe it was about 40 years ago, but I don't know. I'm not, what do you guys think?
I don't know if sort of that idea of that, what people want to do isn't necessarily speaking from our position or my position as a creative wanting to do what many people see as not a real job. But that idea that, no, society needs everyone and every job and every, like, whether that's tradesman or what have you. And just sort of an anecdote of a guy who told a student, who was a teacher, told his student, no, you can't, like, they asked what you want to do, and they said, I want to be a fireman. He said, no, you're far too intelligent to be a fireman, that's a waste on you.
Oh my goodness.
And of course, poor teacher ends up in a fire and needs rescuing. Who rescues them but that student?
Is this an apocryphal tale?
The student who wanted to be a fireman, and it is sort of the fireman was like, I think my teacher thought better of firemen after that.
My son's 15 years old and going through that, you know, what do I do? And just been through exams at 15, and which would, you know, and as a parent you have to make them study, which is just goes against every, you know, kind of, you sit there and regurgitate stuff. But he said he wants to be a tradie. He wants to be an electrician because he loves painting and he loves skating and he loves music. And
he'll make more money than most other people.
He wants to get a job that can pay for the things he loves rather than, you know. And that's when Jacinda said, do what you love, you know, it's how you do that. Just do what you love. Sure. You have to get a job to do that and you pay it, then I just say. And in the arts, you have to do that. It's not a full-time job, is it, really, often? It's not a full-time. How do you two survive?
Oh, I write IT news for business news for the IT industry, rather.
Okay.
It's very exciting.
Wow.
Yeah, but it's not too far away. Yeah. It may feel like it. But can we have a few deets on the shows?
Well, it's shameless promotion time now, isn't it?
It is shameless promotion. I'd really love to hear from you guys.
Shall we start with John, because he's been so talkative?
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Gambler's Guide to Dying. Got a 2-week season at the Basement Theatre, 12th to the 23rd of June, at 6:30 PM. Tickets available either through the Basement website or directly via iTicket.
Fantastic.
Gosh, you've done that before, haven't you?
Yeah, you really have. You're a natural.
Elevator pitch.
Give us a little bit more about premise, just like 30 seconds on what they expect.
So it's about, despite being about death, death is actually all about life and about how we live, and it's about what we live for and what we leave behind, and the legacy that we want to have and the effect that we want to have on those around us.
Nice. Oh, blimey, geez. You're
next show I do, I'm going to do my marketing.
Okay, lovely. Ben.
Hello. So dying, Ashton Brown is dying to meet you, as am I. This coming Friday and Saturday... Can't remember the date, sorry, everyone. But Friday and Saturday.
Friday, April the 20th. Oh, no, that's not
15th
the wrong
and 16th?
Route. Yeah, probably.
The 14th and 15th. Something.
Friday, Saturday. Yeah, everyone 15th, knows 16th. What Friday... Do you guys know what Friday, Saturday is? You'll be fine.
Yeah, it's a day of the week.
Thank you. It's a Poe Theatre in New Lynn. It's a very, very cool theatre. So it's
excellent.
Honestly, even if you just haven't been there before, it's worth going to check out. The show is a lot of fun. Ashton is a huge... energetic personality who you can't help but adore, unfortunately. But
unfortunately. There's a story there, but I'm not going to it now.
Oh, no, it's just...
How long have you two been working together?
So we first met each other actually through a show years and years and years ago. It was one of my first directorial things. It was a Halloween show called Meet. It was very kind of rushed, written by another friend of mine, and it was terrible, but good fun.
Well, at least you can look back and say that.
It was a lot of fun. Ashton was a member of the cast, and we just kind of hit it off.
You clicked.
Yeah.
And what's the running time for Dying to Meet You?
It's an hour.
Yeah. An hour.
And what's your running time?
Oh, I'm a little bit longer. I'm 70 minutes.
Do you have an interval?
No interval, straight through. I promise it won't feel like an hour. It really does fly by.
Okay. Yeah, no, it sounds good.
Well, it won't feel like an hour because it's 70 minutes, which is more than an hour, but that's all right.
And Cavi, how long is the Secret World of Butterflies running for?
It's running for 11 months.
Oh, yeah. No rush.
No rush.
But that's
no
the
rush.
Trouble. You say, oh, no rush, and then you end up never going.
Well, that's
to
what
it.
Happens, eh? Because last week, you see last week of this, and you miss it. Go and see it.
Please come and see it.
It took, I could have stayed there. I had to go because I had another thing. But I, after the opening and the book launch, oh, we should talk about the book as well.
Yes, you
should talk about the book.
Okay.
We would if we had more time, but we do.
The book is The Secret World of Butterflies. The World of Butterflies.
Yeah, so Secret World of Butterflies. It's an amazing illustrated book for kids 3 to 5.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Brilliant.
Yep.
But it's a free exhibition, isn't it?
That's right. It's on the second floor
of
the museum, Sainsbury Horrocks Gallery. It's a free exhibition. Amazing if you have young kids, especially, but for everyone.
Yeah. I enjoyed it, and I'm not a young kid.
There's lots of cool, stinky, smelly, interesting things to make funny noises and things you can make and set up on the wall.
Make a day of it, eh? It's because museums are so different from what they were 20 years ago. They're so interactive, and it's a fantastic museum. So
awesome.
Lovely. Thank you. And Alison...
Yes, so I'll put a plug out there for everybody buying a copy of Two Eye, A Traveller in Two Worlds by Alison Jones and Kuni Carr Jenkins. It's a really easy read, and you can read it like a book. It's not an academic history at all. It is actually a story about a man's life, and it's quite a tragic story, but a really rich story. And it's $45 from a good bookstore near you.
And who's the publisher?
Bridget Williams Books.
Brilliant.
Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I'm at that stage where I pick it up every night before bed and read at least 2 chapters.
It's a page-turner.
It is a page-turner.
Because you're just fascinated by it. There's a whole lot of stuff in there, and I work in this area in another life, and the whole lot of stuff in there that I wasn't even aware of, and it was really nice to read a really frank history of someone who's a minor celebrity, you know, in that world. So yeah,
and all those great pictures. Read.
Good on you. Good choice. Love
kia ora.
It. I hope to see more.
Yeah.
I might lend you my copy, Paula.
I'd like to.
And have a read through.
Yeah, definitely. So. I've got a whole pile of books at the moment. But
so much great stuff going on in Auckland, isn't there?
Yeah.
And how are you doing? So you're nearly finished.
I know. Your first God, night. I'm holding my breath. Night,
how do you think, if we were going to do a review of Paula?
Oh, no. We'd do it like the amphitheatre.
Yeah. No, we won't do it like that, because that means we have to get some lions.
She does pretty well for a poem, really.
Oh, thank you. Yes. I know that's an import. Huge compliment.
Yeah,
it's been great. It's great having you as a wingman.
Oh, thanks.
Especially as there's a few technical hitches at the beginning of the show.
Yeah, we just about didn't go to air, and I really want to say thank you to our guests for being very patient, because when we got here, the transmitter wasn't working, which is a little bit weird. But
and when does that happen?
That's the second time that's happened in 6 years.
Yeah,
we came back live just as I used a word that I wouldn't repeat in front of my children.
Before the watershed.
It created much hilarity here and kick-ups.
Yeah.
So you're going to be back next week, or are you going to take a week
off? I'm reviewing.
What are you going to see?
I'm going to see Preyas Theatre Company on Thursday, so I'll be reviewing it on Sunday with you. So I'll be sitting there.
Dara.
And you'll be... Yeah, that's right, Dara. Yeah. And we spoke to 2 people from that theatre company last week.
Yes.
So I'll be back next week.
Awesome.
Yeah.
You did a great job.
Oh, thank you so much.
Are you going to sign off, or do you want me to do it?
Oh, no, I'll sign off.
Got 22.
Okay, I'm going
to
go for it.
I know that
you did it so beautifully. thank you so much. It's been a great show.
It has.
Good luck to everybody here with all of their creative projects, and hope everything goes well. Tune in next week at 8. Thanks to listeners. I've been Paula Crimmins. Looking forward to seeing you next week on June the 17th. Go out there and
kick some arts. And you just did that perfectly.